Hello, everyone. This is Ben Greenfield. I have been in California for the past week, and I've actually been a very good boy. I've been being very careful here in California because of what we're going to talk about on today's podcast, and that would be California's juice of choice. That's right, wine. I know there's been a lot of wine podcasts kind of floating around out there lately, like healthy wine podcasts. I guarantee the wine discussion that we have today is not the same old version of some of those podcasts that you may have already heard. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? Yeah, check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off.
In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, not even more alcohol. It's actually around the standard of what a typical Cabernet or Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc is. But we did it with no residual sugar. So many wines that we out there that will go on the drier side or wanted to look at a lower calorie, they did it by lowering the alcohol content. And that wasn't our objective.
Grapes typically that are raised at elevation, cooler climates and kind of a, I don't know if you want to call it a rougher terrain, but more of a mountainous region. Most of our grapes come from over 2,000 feet of elevation. It has an impact on the growth of the grape.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and a few months ago, I released this article. The article was called Dark and Dirty Secrets of the Wine Industry, Four Ways to Make Wine Healthier, and What Kind of Wine Fit People Should Drink. Well, in that article, I talked about a ton of serious issues with wine, stuff like arsenic and overpricing, lack of sustainability, high levels of sulfites and amines and ochratoxins, boatloads of unnecessary sugars, high pH levels that actually increase the possibility of contamination by unwanted organisms in the wine, less than stellar taste, plastic polyethylenes, a ton of problems that plague the modern wine industry and actually cause a lot of people, including my wife, Jessa, to get things like headaches, or me myself to get things like poor sleep from a nightly glass of wine. And at the end of that article, which I'll link to in the show notes for this podcast, you can get the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/healthywine. At the end of that article, I highlighted that that I'm now drinking different kinds of wine. I've kind of switched up what I choose when I get wine, and I make specific choices. And one of the wines that I've been drinking in particular, and that I have this habit now in the evenings, one of my 8-year-old boys who know how to open wine better than I do, they'll open the wine for me. They get it. They do the latte frother technique that I learned from Tim Ferriss, where they stick a latte frother in there and they froth it for about 60 seconds and they bring it to me. The bottles that I've been choosing lately are these bottles of Cabernet called Fit Vine Wine. And in today's podcast, I have the co-founder of Fit Vine Wine, who is a real, almost like a biohacker when it comes to figuring out how to make wine healthy. He's also a national level black belt competitor in Taekwondo. He's a CrossFitter. And of course, as a wine enthusiast and a father of two boys, he's a man after my own heart, Mark Warren of Fit Vine Wine. So Mark, welcome to the show, man.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ben. Very excited to be on and talk with you about this.
Yeah, no problem, man. And I'm kind of curious to hear your wine story, because I personally used to be a total wine geek. Like when I graduated from college, I worked in a pub where we served wine, so I had to study wine all through college. Then when I graduated, I got the wine Bible and I started going to blind wine tastings. And my wife and I, almost every single week, were at some kind of local winery doing wine tastings. And that all culminated with us doing a bicycling tour of Italy, in which we literally rode our bikes from Rome up to Florence and drank wine all the way up from Rome to Florence. And eventually, I got into like Iron Man and stuff and started to drink less than the copious amounts of wine that I had been into up until that point. And I don't do as much geeking out on wine as I used to. But I used to be big into wine. I'm curious what your story is with wine, like how you kind of got into this industry.
Yeah, mine's not nearly as a romantic story as traveling with your wife up and down the coast of Italy. But I did grow up on a lot of homemade wine. You know, being part Italian, it was always in the house. And I think a lot of that stuff back then, though, tasted horrible.
You guys actually made it?
My family did.
Really?
My grandfather did before he passed, and then my stepfather's family was Sicilian, and they made their own wines. Back then, you know, I started, 9, 10, 11 years old. They'd give you a 2 or 3 ounce pour during holiday dinners or something, and, you know, it tasted to me like gasoline. Now, whether or not that was intentional because they really didn't want us to drink alcohol or not, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. The homemade wine thing is interesting. My wife actually has a giant vat. We found an elderberry tree out on the edge of our property, and she has a giant vat of elderberry wine actually fermenting out in the garage right now. And she said it's not going to be ready until June, but every time I walk past it, I'm pretty curious as to what it's actually going to taste like. So the whole homemade wine thing can be a risky business, I agree, from a taste standpoint. But now you're doing a lot more than homemade wine. I mean, you have this full-on wine company. So how did that actually emerge? When did that enter the picture?
Yeah, a few years back, you know, as you mentioned, was always in fitness. One of my other co-founders, Tom, we built a couple businesses together. He had played hockey all through college. And, you know, we've always tried to stay healthy, just being active, whether, you know, surfing, paddleboarding, skiing. And we've always enjoyed wine. But we felt like there was a hole. Tying that into what we'll call the active lifestyle. Not so much, you don't have to be an athlete like yourself, a professional triathlete, but the everyday person that wants to stay healthy, that, you know, has a family, career, they're busy, they try and work out, you know, 2 or 3 days a week or be active, whether it's yoga, jogging, something, but still want to enjoy a glass of wine. And we felt as we researched it more that wine is very intimidating to people because it's not like, if you drink beer, you usually either drink domestic or import. If you drink import, you like your specific crafts. If you drink hard alcohol, usually there, I drink vodka or gin, rum, bourbon, and then they're kind of branded with whatever it is, and that's as far as it goes. But wine, there's so much choice. There's a store that's a national store. One is right down the road from me. It's called Total Wines. They have 8,000 bottles of wine. So
yeah.
Many people can walk in and they're very, very overwhelmed.
But that's, I mean, in my opinion, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, like when I was into wine, that was one of the cool things was being able to, for example, have a sommelier walk up to your table at a fancy restaurant and dump like this entire Bible on the table. And then you got to go through it and have a little conversation about, you know, the different flavors and the nuances in literally dozens and dozens and dozens of different types of wine. And then you narrow it down and you choose the perfect one to go with, you know, your fish or your quinoa or your rabbit or your steak or whatever it is that you're eating. Like I don't really personally think having a lot of options is an issue. As much as I think some of the issues are what I began to discover when I started to look into the wine industry and, you know, some of the things that like you and a lot of other people, you know, like my friend Mark Sisson, I know he's been looking into this, and you know, Dave Asprey, another guy who does a lot of like biohacking, he's been looking into this, and there are some issues with the wine industry. That's what I'm curious to hear you talk about is what exactly is going on with wine that goes above and beyond just the fact that there's a billion of them out there.
Yeah. And that's kind of what the next step of what I was going to lead that into is that, you know, the vast amount of choices, that's kind of the first hurdle for people. But then people don't know what's in wine or the quality of wine and price. It's not like price can dictate that. So it's not like, oh, just stay away from $3 bottles of wine and you'll be fine. There's plenty of wine out there that's in the $15 to $20 range. It's, has the same issues as some of the $2 wines. And the more we researched it ourselves and got into it, you know, because it's not well-known knowledge, you know, as a primary thing is the government allows 74 different additives to wine. So it's almost looked at now that wine can, you can look at wine like food.
Well, when you say additives, what do you mean?
So they, you know, there's fillers, there's certain chemicals that you can add sugar or sugar concentrates that they can add multiple things to adjust tastings. So it's unnecessary things that don't need to be in there. Just like when you're buying your food, what's the difference of buying 99-cent ground hamburger to grass fed? You know, or you're picking up something and it's got 37 ingredients on the back of the box instead of just being natural. So it's kind of gone down that path, unfortunately. And the issue really, Ben, is it's not all wine, but how do you decipher which wines are like that and which aren't? Because it's not on the label.
Well, one of the things that I noticed, and sorry about interrupting you, but I wanted to mention this article that I read about California winemakers and how they got sued over arsenic in wine. This was part of a bunch of articles that appeared in the headlines a couple of months ago, where they talked about how they were showing that wine, like the typical wine from California, had like 4 to 5 times the maximum amount of arsenic that the EPA allowed for in drinking water. But what I don't understand is, how does arsenic get into wine? Like, what's the process in the winemaking process if you wish something like that would actually happen?
You know, it's coming out of the grapes and then also the pesticides. So if they're spraying the grapes, you know, the scientific breakdown of, I don't know the exact, you know, I can't tell you it's these three things that are causing it, but it's typically coming from the grapes being sprayed and the lack of proper filtration and fermentation. They're not taking the time for the wine to mature like it should inside its fermentation process, and they're turning things around too fast to just mass produce it. You know, that can be some of the results of it, as well as the quality of the grapes. You know, are they sprayed? Are they GMO? You know, what's happening to those grapes before they're even being processed for the wine? So it's
grapes can be GMO.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah. I thought it was just like beets. There are a few others, like beet and corn. Some forms of wheat, but grapes also, they're genetically modifying grapes now too, huh?
That's what we've heard. I mean, it's
interesting.
Unfortunately, they're kind of going down the path with anything with that. But so it's really paying attention to the source of where you're getting your stuff from. And then, you know, everything takes time. So the longer something takes time, the more, of course, it costs more money. So if you're a large conglomerate and, you know, if you bought a smaller winery or you're doing something, you bought a brand and you want to make it more profitable, they're cutting corners. So cutting those corners and doing things that shouldn't be done are causing after effects like arsenic showing up in wine.
What about, and this is something I hear about in farming, that they like turn over the soil too quickly in farming, and that results in lack of minerals and some of the fruits and the vegetables that we eat due to poor soil practices. When it comes to wine and like the soil that wine is grown in, or the irrigation practices of wine, is that something that varies from winery to winery as well? Like what should you look for as far as like the way that the wine was irrigated or the soil it was grown in?
Yeah, and that goes into what's called the terrier. And that's, you could have an entire podcast on that because it goes into some of the teachings of what they call the old European wineries, that they protect the land that only will grow a certain way, that they, you know, some of the European laws don't even allow them to irrigate in certain areas or do certain things to the soil. So there's multiple levels. I mean, I know it's not a yes or no answer, but there are multiple levels of what the water can do. Ultimately, irrigation is changing the growth of the grapes, whether it's too much or too little water. If the grapes don't grow enough and they're smaller, they're going to be sweeter. So if you want a higher sugar content, so a lot of times they can manipulate those things. But soil does have a very large impact on the taste of the wine. And to answer your question, turning it over too much or too little, that's not my background of farming, so I don't know. I won't try to give you the right answer of, you know, what if they do too much or too little on how it's affecting it. But soil does have a very large impact on the taste of the wine and the impact of the grapes, as well as the water does, because if you're trying to force water into it and you're trying to basically overbloat the grapes, it's going to have an effect on its internal contents.
Interesting. Now, what about the type of water being used? Does that matter? Like if the water is, you know, I guess like when we return to this concept of like arsenic or some of the other things that I know are in water now, like, you know, everything from birth control pills to fluoride to chlorine, things along those lines. Does the quality of the water that's being used matter?
Again, I don't have the exact answer on that, Ben, but I know that, again, going back to some of the old European winery laws, they only allow rainwater. So I'm sure that if you're taking, you know, tainted water, it's going to affect it. So if they're irrigating with unhealthy water, there has to be some sort of impact there. And that's the stuff that's not currently being identified, or if it is, it's not being put out there yet. So I'm sure if wines are starting to flag more with things like arsenic, that will get stricter with the government.
What do you mean that rainwater? You mean like they don't use irrigation at all? You only get water on the wine when it rains?
From certain old wineries in France, in Germany, yes. And some of the areas are starting to lighten up on that, like Spain just kind of loosened up their hold on that. So some of these wineries, that is the case.
Okay. Got it. So we've got arsenic, we've got potential for GMO, whatever might be found in the water if the water is used in the wrong way to irrigate the wine. Are there other common chemical additives or issues that people should be concerned about in the wine that they're drinking or that they should look for?
Yeah, I mean, it's more the additives than chemicals. I mean, you know, the chemicals that flag, you know, really ended up being arsenic, but it's the amount of sulfites, the overabundance of them. You know, a lot of wines are sitting upwards of 150 parts per million, which is a lot. Sugar, you know, in California, they call it chaptalization. You're not legally allowed to add sugar in California. You can in Bordeaux, France, and Oregon, but California and other areas do allow a grape concentrate to be added, which is the same thing as adding sugar. They're looking to add and make it sweeter.
What's a grape concentrate?
It's like grape juice. So really? It's like a concentrated grape juice to affect the content of the wine and the acid control. So what they'll do is if the pH is off and trying to balance it out instead of doing it naturally, they'll add stuff like calcium carbonate, which is basically chalk, or like an acid, like a tartar acid or malic acid or a citric acid to, again, try and bring the pH levels to where it should be.
Really? So what is it about pH? Why would you have to do that to adjust the pH of a wine versus the wine just having the correct pH from the get-go?
Well, the pH is crucial. The pH is what's really controlling the taste, the texture, the smell in your mouth. And if that's off, it's, you know, it's not going to taste very good. But yes, so it should be done naturally. So part of how we do it naturally is sourcing particular grapes, the grapes that we source where they're tested in the beginning for what their pH levels are. So you're starting out with and again, I'm not the chemist, one of our other co-founders, Zach, is, he could speak better to this in chemistry details, but you're going to hit a range. So you don't want to be too high or too low because then no matter what, it won't come out. So the grapes that they're sourcing from the beginning are sitting within a particular range so that during the fermentation process, we do an extended fermentation, they're checking that pH level throughout, so that they can make sure that it's getting optimized and not being too high or too low or having to add anything to do it. So our wines sit at about 3.4 for the pH level. And if I remember correctly off the top of my head, I think Cab optimal, like perfect level, is like 3.35. And I think the Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blancs should sit somewhere in the range of like 3.4, 3.41. So we're very, very, very close to usually being spot on with it, which, you know, it makes a huge difference with the wine.
Okay, so that's because of the actual grape that you're using or the time at which you're harvesting the grape. And because of that, that means that you don't have to add like sugar, extra sugars, or added like grape juice or grape concentrates because you're actually choosing a grape that has the correct pH from the get-go. Is that right?
Yes, that okay. And the extended fermentation. So,
well, why wouldn't everybody just choose that grape from the get-go? Like, why wouldn't a commercial winemaker just choose a grape with the correct pH rather than adding sugar or grape concentrate?
Because it costs more money. And then what okay. do you do with those grapes if they don't match? So if they're, okay. you know, if they're harvesting tons of grapes and, you know, you've got a, you know, 5 tons that aren't exactly where you want it to be, and you're pushing out, you know, millions of bottles, or millions of cases a year, you know, you're really pushing down okay. that needle of what's coming to it. And it takes longer. So, you know, our turnaround time for our wine is a lot longer than what a lot of these larger brands are doing to make their wine.
Okay. What else affects pH? You were just about to say something else, I think.
Well, going back to the irrigation. So if they're, like I said, if they're over flooding in, you know, or not giving enough water and that grape becomes sweeter, that's also going to affect its pH level. Like all those things inside the grape will be affected based on its water.
Okay, got it. So we've got water and pH. Now, the other thing that you mentioned was sulfides. And I wanted to ask you about this because you said like 150 parts per million were some of the amounts of sulfites in wine. But my understanding, and I've looked into this a little bit with my wife, because I thought that her getting headaches after she drank wine was due to the sulfites. But it looks like a lot of foods, like, for example, potato chips, for example, have extremely high levels of sulfites in them. And a lot of other foods have sulfites, like, you know, deli meat and dressings and a lot of snack foods and cereals. And I know, like, herbs and spices have, I mean, if you look at the label, they'll have sulfur dioxide or potassium bisulfite or sodium sulfite. And it seems like a lot of these foods would be giving you big headaches too, in the same way that wine does, if it was just the sulfites. So is it really, like, are sulfites really an issue when it comes to wine? I mean, is that something you should be even trying to control, or is it something else in wine that could be causing things like what people think are wine allergies or headaches?
Yeah, so, I mean, the short answer is yes. The long answer is still yes. And the reason why it's different than a potato chip or a particular fruit or something is because it's not the sulfites by themselves. So it's a combination. So the combination of sulfites with alcohol and the combination of sulfites and sugar and additives and everything else that's in there are affecting people. Now, you know, there are very few people who are truly allergic to the sulfur. I mean, they can't eat a lot of things and they can't take certain medications and stuff. So they can't drink wine at all. But the sensitivities that people are having tend to be a combination of numerous things, whether it's the wine just wasn't filtered correctly, whether it's filtered through wheat and it's now not gluten-free, which it should be, you know, the additives, the sulfites combined with the additives. So it's...
What do you mean? You filter wine through wheat?
So wine naturally should be gluten-free, but, you know, these are all things that we hear coming about. There's companies that have been cutting corner and filtering through wheat, which, you know, is not not good. So that has an impact on the wine and how it's going to affect people. I mean, people who don't have allergies but may have some sort of gluten sensitivity and they can drink a glass of wine and have no impact. They drink another glass of wine, suddenly they're like stuffy and feel like they're congested. And that's a mix of like what's being done, filtering the wine, the sulfites, the additives and what's in it. So it's just, it becomes too much of what's inside the wine. I mean, you shouldn't have to have that many sulfites in the wine to stabilize it.
I don't understand why you'd have to filter a wine through wheat. How does that even happen? Like why would you choose wheat as something to filter wine through?
I don't, you know, from what we hear, it's cost. It's very cheap. You know, I wouldn't even consider it. So I'm not quite sure, but you know, these are the things that, you know, that have been starting to trickle out of some of the corners that are being cut. You know, I mean, some of the things you see out there, I mean, you see wine out there for $3.99 a bottle, you know, and that store had to make a profit. The distributor had to make a profit. So you can imagine.
Yeah. Two buck Chuck, baby. I used to go through a bunch of $2 Chuck. That was my go-to.
And they were flagged as one of the companies out there with arsenic. So, you know, it's
good tasting wine though for $2. turns out it had a bunch of crap in it. But I'm curious, like, if you're not going to filter wine through wheat, what do you filter wine through?
So we filter through diatomaceous earth and micron pads, and the micron pads are, I think it's 0.45. I mean, they're the tightest that they can be. So it's top of the line. You can't get any better. We do a double filtration, and the white wines are being cold stabilized, which the wine's brought down to 34 degrees, and it helps any of the impurities that could be in there to raise to the top, and they filter it again. So again, it's more time. So what we're doing takes more time than some of the other ways of doing it, but it makes for a cleaner wine. So we're, you know, and it costs more money. So what, you know, our wine is being made for, and it costs us probably at least 2, if not 2.5 times the cost of what similarly priced wines are being made for out there.
Mm, got it. So in terms of, I want to return to this sulfite issue again. I don't want to kick this horse to death too much, but one of the things that I understand that people get sensitive to and that can cause migraines and headaches from food are histamines. and other forms of what are called amines. Is there a way to reduce those from the wine that you drink? Because again, like I mentioned, I'm still trying to figure out why my wife doesn't get headaches from your wine. And I'm not convinced it's the sulfides, but do you know much about amines, like histamines, or if the way that a wine is produced can increase or decrease the amount of histamines that are in it?
You know, and I don't have the answer for that, Ben. And I know that some wines get flagged for mold, or, you know, I had a customer reach out to me and ask me if we used a particular glue to seal something on there or whatever. And she said that the glue was known for having some sort of histamine to it. I've never even heard of it, but I mean, we get questions asked to us by customers that they find stuff, and it brings knowledge to us that I don't know if it's just some of the agents they use, whether it's bottling or sealing the wine or that's what it was. It was the glue and sealing the barrels that had something in it that caused the wine to then be affected. I had never heard of it before. So, you know, I guess there's other things like that, but typically the allergen piece or the histamine piece, from the way I understand it, would be more of a tracking back to a mold. So if the wine, again, was not, pH can affect that as well. So if the pH is off, you know, that can lead for things inside the wine to grow.
Well, I know that's the deal with coffee. Like, I've talked with Dave before, who does Bulletproof Coffee, and he talks about how they don't soak the coffee beans for a long period of time. Like, it's some kind of like a continuous flow process the way they do their coffee, so it has lower levels of mold in it. And apparently, and I know there's controversy out there about this, apparently a lot of other coffee makers do the same thing, and this has been going on like since the 70s or whatever, that a lot of them are doing like a continuous flow process where the coffee beans don't soak for long periods of time. Is there a variation in soaking times for different types of grapes? Like, is there a difference between like how long your grapes are soaking? Or I think it's called maceration or something like that, like soaking or maceration compared to other wines.
That I'm not going to guess at. Okay. Because that's more of Zach's forte. So I okay. could. Unfortunately, I don't have that answer. I could get that answer for
Dang
you.
It. We got to get Zach here. We got to ask him these questions. Is that true though? Do grapes actually get soaked in the winemaking process?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be part of that is when they're being cleaned. You know, is when they're first run through to, you know, remove anything that was as they're being, you know, pulled. So you know, whether or not it's being done longer than others, I think that comes down more to, you know, sitting inside the fermentation process.
Okay.
That, you know, I mean, like inside the fermentation, that's where the longevity will be different. Like ours, we do an extended fermentation. So I know that for sure makes a huge difference on the wine. But
what does that mean? What is extended fermentation?
So, you know, some of the wines are being turned around in, you know, 3 to 4 days, and we're doing ours in a 10 to 15 day time frame in that initial fermentation. So that's where we're focusing on that pH level. You know, instead of, well, let's just, you know, pull it out in 3 days and then add what we need to get things where taste wise where we want to be.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And that's also, and this is something I like about your wines I talked about in that article. Is that why they're higher in alcohol?
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. So when you ferment for a long period of time like that, from what I understand, you're adjusting the pH in a way that allows you to not have to like add extra sugars and concentrates and stuff. But when you're fermenting for a long time, because my wife does kombucha, right? And you add a bunch of sugar to kombucha, but then the bacteria ferment the sugar and you don't get an end product that's high in sugar. With wine, when you're doing a long fermentation, is basically what's going on, the sugar is getting converted into higher amounts of alcohol. So the end product is a wine with less sugar and more alcohol.
Correct.
Okay, got it. Now, is that why you do that? Like, just to create a wine with more alcohol? You just like to.
Well, it's not.
Are you just a closet drunk?
Yeah, it's actually not. It's not even more alcohol. It's actually around the standard of what a typical Cabernet or Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc is. But we did it with no residual sugar. So many wines that will be out there that will go on the drier side or wanted to look at a lower calorie. They did it by lowering the alcohol content. And that wasn't our objective. In the beginning, you know, our wines do have a little less calories and carbohydrates, but that wasn't our objective. We weren't looking to make a low-cal wine and create some kind of numbers game. It was more focusing on a clean wine that had no residual sugar. And it just, the byproduct of that happened to bring down the carbohydrates and calories a little. But we also wanted to make sure that it maintained its alcohol. You know, a typical Cabernet does sit in that 13.5 to 14.1, 14.2 range, and ours is at 13.9. So we didn't want to be, you know, bring forth a wine that people felt that it was not up to par with a typical Cabernet or Chardonnay that they were drinking because it had less alcohol. Because that will, it does make a difference in its taste. If you've had wine that sits in the 9, 10, 10.5 range, it's a dramatic difference taste than a 13.5.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, I noticed a big difference. So this is basically a long fermentation. On your website, you say that your wines go through what's called a malolactic secondary fermentation to lower the pH levels and make like a clean, good tasting wine. Is that the same? Is that just like fancy word for long fermentation, malolactic secondary fermentation?
Yeah, and it's just, yeah, it's a type of fermentation that's being done. And in that process, it's, you know, it's clean. So it's top of the line. So there's no weird things in there, or, you know, we've heard of eggshells and everything else that they can add or put in to try and, you know, inside of adjusting pH levels. So it's basically a clean way of doing the fermentation process, so it's not having any effect on the wine.
Okay, so that allows you to get your pH levels at the right level, so you don't have to add sugars or additives or things like extra sulfites.
Correct.
Okay, got it. Now, what about mold? You mentioned mold earlier. I know that folks have talked about ochratoxin or ochratoxin, or however you want to pronounce it, in wine. Do you think that's an issue? Is that something that you've tried to control? Or what's going on as far as mold is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, you know, ochratoxins, I mean, I've not had that actually come across any conversations about our wine or anybody else's wine. So I'm not going to discount somebody write an article about it or whatever, when I know that it had come up as well about coffee. And, you know, our wine does get tested by an independent lab, so we don't have issues with mold or arsenic or any other, you know, thing like that. So we're aware of, I mean, it's a live thing. You know, wine is, it's a live item. So, you know, anything could generate, you know, mold or mildew or anything. So, you know, if you don't do things properly, you know, you could have negative effects from it. So we do, you know, make sure that we're constantly testing the wine and being, you know, aware of our processes. And that's why we do spend extra time and extra money and do top of the line filtration and fermentation to, you know, protect the wine and make clean wines.
Do all wineries test their wine like that?
No.
Okay. So what's going on? Like you're taking the wine and you're sending it off to some, like what's a lab test that tests for wine? Like, why would you do something like that?
There's different levels of it. So, you know, most liquor companies and wineries, even beer, will send it out to test to, you know, make sure it's coming in what they're stating for alcohol content or calories or carbs. We went the extra step. I mean, we did the top of the line litany of every test that could be out there just to see if there was, you know, we're saying this is what we're doing. We want somebody to independently say, yes, there's nothing in the wine. You know, it's clean. There's no arsenic flagging or mold or whatever. We checked for calories, carbohydrates, resveratrol, everything. So anything that they could test for, we did.
Really? Do you produce those tests anywhere? Like, is there a place somebody could go download that?
No, we haven't done that yet. In that,
you should.
I know. there's been a little, and I won't, you know, get into it too much, but there's been a little kind of pushback by what's called the TTB. They're the Federal Regulation Board of the ATF that overlooks alcohol. We've had some gentle push and shoves because we tried to put the calories and carbohydrates on there. We did it in the first couple of labels. They made us take it off. We had to adjust some of our language because we said for the active lifestyle that had to be removed. We had beneficial compounds that had to be removed. So they make you, there's a very long list of what you cannot say.
I didn't know that. Well, that is true. When you look at a lot of wines, like it, or alcohol in general, a lot of times it doesn't tell you carbs or calories or anything like that.
Correct. And in Europe, it does. So, you know, in the United States, we've been fighting for a long time.
I don't know. Whenever I've had wine in Europe, it just comes to your table in a giant carafe and you drink it. Barely even see the bottle. It just goes straight down the hatch.
Thought it was, you know, beneficial to go that route, they lobbied for it.
That is true. I've always wondered why they don't have labels on the wine that you bring to the table. And so the issue is what again? Why wouldn't they allow that?
They don't want you to make health claims. So, you know, the beer industry lobbied for it once they decided they wanted to go the route of the calorie fight. You know, I have a light, now I have an ultra light, now I have the super light, you know, and they all fight for, you know, 5 less calories or something. So when they decided to go that marketing route by cutting alcohol and, you know, adding water, they lobbied for it and they got it. So the wine industry hasn't done that, and it's, you know, still a protected thing, and they don't want it out there.
You talked about resveratrol, and, you know, when it comes to making health claims about wine, I know we've got like resveratrol, and there's all sorts of antioxidants in wine, you know, like polyphenols and anthocyanidins and all sorts of stuff that you get from the grape skins. One thing that you were telling me about was that you can actually choose grapes or grow grapes in a way that concentrates the antioxidants. Can you talk about that, like how you actually concentrate these specific antioxidants that are in the grapes?
Yeah, so it's grapes typically that are raised at elevation, cooler climates, and kind of a, I don't know if you want to call it a rougher terrain, but, you know, more of a mountainous region. Most of our grapes come from over 2,000 feet of elevation. It has an impact on the growth of the grape. Grapes almost have to kind of fight for, you know, fight harder to be in that type of region. And it does affect the strength level of, you know, those compounds in the grapes. And then inside the fermentation process, because that extended fermentation process is being done, it's fully getting all those out of the grapes. Know where, if, you know, you're cutting that time short, it cuts time from, you know, allowing the full extraction of those beneficial compounds to the grape.
That's interesting. I was doing an interview with a guy who creates like this plant herb formulation that I drink called Tianqi. It's like a bunch of Chinese adaptogenic herbs, and he said that he specifically chooses herbs out of China where they grow them in these extremely hardy conditions, like on these farms. And, you know, we were joking back and forth about how they like whip the herbs and beat the herbs. But it really is true. Like they grow them under extremely harsh conditions. And it's interesting because when you look at wild plants and the amount of antioxidants in wild plants, they get concentrated when the plants are grown in harsh climates. Yep. And so what you're saying is you're going out of your way to choose grapes that are grown in like these high, cool areas with less irrigation so that the grapes have to go through a harder time so they produce more endogenous antioxidants.
Yeah, and it's the antioxidants, and then that happened to also be the grapes that had better pH levels, more consistent pH levels that, you know, work right into what we were looking to do.
Yeah, plants are interesting like that. Like, have you ever heard of this book called Eating on the Wild Side by Jo Robinson? She goes into how when you get kale, what you do is, or any other type of like dark leafy green, you rip it up at night, like the night before you're going to eat it or put it in a smoothie, and it thinks it's being eaten by a wild animal. And so it produces a bunch more endogenous antioxidants. So the next morning when you eat it, you're actually getting more antioxidants than if you just like, you know, taking it whole out of the bag or out of the garden and throwing it in your blender.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, super interesting. So you can basically do the same thing with grapes. You're beating up the grapes, you get more concentrated amounts of resveratrol and polyphenols and stuff like that.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's the grape, like I said, the grapes are, it's almost like they're fighting for their lives. And it's, and, you know, we're not the only ones who do it. And there's a lot of small vineyards in Europe that do it. And in the U.S., actually, the first one to kind of really drive that route was Jess Jackson, who founded Kendall Jackson.
Okay.
He took things out of the typical areas of where grapes were being grown. He was going after specific, like, hillsides. And he was very much into the terrier of the terrain and the soil and stuff like that. And it does make a, you know, difference in the grapes.
Where do you grow your grapes?
Most of our grapes will be in Lodi, California, but based on yields, we can we work with some other farms when needed to source additional grapes. And again, they have to meet our standards of what we're looking for.
Okay, that's like in the Sierra foothills, right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. All right, so basically, when it comes down to implications for health, what we're talking about is less sugar or less like concentrated carbohydrates. and more antioxidants. Like that would be the in a nutshell. And then less sulfites and less arsenic or better laboratory testing for any of these artificial additives, and more concentrated antioxidants.
Correct.
Okay. And of course the biggie for me, more alcohol.
Yes.
A lot of people think that's a bad thing. I think it's great. Like I love it when I can drink a glass of wine and it spins the dials in my brain just a little bit more. Again, not that I'm a one glass of wine a day type of person, because I actually think that having more than one drink a day, you know, for me personally, I don't feel that great. I self-quantify my sleep and the amount of time that I spend in deep sleep cycles, and you know how I feel the next day, and I test my testosterone levels, and I know that a glass of wine a day is like the perfect area for me. So I always, every night, it's either a glass of wine or else I take kombucha and I put a shot of vodka and I squeeze half a lemon into a kombucha. And those are my two drinks of choice. And I actually did a podcast on kombucha last month where we talked about how kombucha actually gets converted to gluconic and glucuronic acid, which are both liver cleanses. And so you're drinking alcohol, and at the same time, it's kind of cleansing your liver. So that's my other drink of choice. But I do have more questions for you. You talk about how your wine is biodynamically and organically farmed. What's that mean for wine to be biodynamically farmed?
Well, really, I mean, in the U.S., they don't actually put a legal label on biodynamic. So really, the difference is just what you're doing in raising the grapes and how you're farming. So, and that's us, as I said, we're taking longer times for filtering, double filtering, and the extended fermentation. So it's biodynamic. It's kind of more of a loose term of it, more of can be really open to interpretation. Organic is controlled by the U.S. government of what the actual term is. So we're not certified organic, but all our grapes are pesticide free. To go through that certification is a long process, which at this time we're not investing in for many other reasons. But there's two types of organic. So what they'll say is the first type of organic is that we use, you know, whether you're using certified organically grown grapes, avoiding any synthesized additives or anything like that. So again, we're not, that's why ours doesn't say organic on it, because we haven't gone through the certification for it, but we use all pesticide-free grapes and there are no additives. The secondary step to that is organic wines, which again are made from organically grown grapes, but also there are no sulfites added at all. And it's just the whatever sulfites have been naturally found in the wine. So that has a much different shelf life to the wine. So we won't go that path. We found that we've been able to make a nice full body, clean wine with minimal sulfites added. So it are sit at about 35 parts per million, which is very low, but they still contain more than, you know, that organic wine.
You said other wines are at, did you say 150?
Yeah, so that's not all wines. I mean, you know, I couldn't tell you how many thousands of different wines in the world, but a typical wine will sit somewhere in the range of 75 to 150 parts per million.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I still think it's something else other than the sulfites that are causing issues. Again, because I watch my wife and she she consumes like packaged foods or foods that do contain some sulfites and doesn't get headaches. And it's always the different kind of wines. I think it has something to do with like this soaking process that you talked about, or the amount of tyramine or histamine in some of these non-organic wines. Or I know we can't say you guys are organic because you're not like certified organic, but these wines that use pesticides and you know, and stuff like that. So either way though, you've got no residual sugar, lower amounts of carbohydrates, and way less sulfites, or way fewer sulfites. Yep. Okay.
And to pinpoint it, Ben, I mean, just like, yeah, I mean, you know, you've worked with people, thousands of people around the world when it comes to nutrition. Everybody's different. Everybody's body is affected differently. That's why nutrition coaches, you know, can struggle sometimes, because you could line up 100 people and all 100 of those people will be affected differently by foods. So the same thing is, you know, to kind of just say a blanket statement of it's this is tough, because everybody's body reacts to something different. So it could be one thing in the wine for somebody and another thing in there for somebody else. So it's, but definitely making a cleaner wine does make it less impactful.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Now, another thing that you mentioned was you talked about, I think you used the word cold stabilize. We were talking about the filtration process, and you said you use like diatomaceous earth and micron pads rather than wheat to filter your wine. But you also mentioned something about how it's cold stabilized. What does that mean?
So white wine should be cold stabilized. So we cold stabilize, it brings it down to 34 degrees. And what happens is it allows any kind of impurity in the wines to kind of raise up inside the vats to then be filtered out. Because if not, if that's not done and you go put your white wine in the refrigerator, it can crystallize. And that crystallization can be the impurities. So, and it can be sugars or whatever else in there. So it's just another step to help, you know, keep the white wines clean.
Okay. Got it. Now, there is a lot of talk right now about healthy wines. I know that, like I mentioned, my friend Mark Sisson has talked about wine. He was recently on the Joe Rogan podcast, and he was talking about how he's drinking this wine called, I think it's called Dry Farm Wines. And I've tried those too. I actually had a bottle of Dry Farm Wines last night because they sent me some to try. And I know that Dave Asprey, another guy who's a friend of mine, he's also talked a lot lately about healthy wines and choosing, you know, the special kinds of wines, you know, kind of using processes like we've just talked about. I've tried your guys's wine. And I've tried the dry farm wines, and both frankly they're really good wines. But one thing that I noticed, and again, I'll just be totally straightforward. And, you know, I had a conversation with the folks at Dry Farm Wines. They seem like awesome people and their wine is good, but your wine is better. And the reason that I like your wine more is because it's darker and more rich, and I thought that their stuff was kind of watery. Why is that? Because I know that you both use like biodynamic processes, and you both use like wine grown at high elevations and you know, concentrated for antioxidants, and you're all kind of like jumping through these healthy wine hoops. Why is it that your wine seems darker and more rich and more flavorful when I drink it?
And be honest with you, I haven't tried their wines, but I'm excited that there's other people out there, you know, trying to push the same message we are. So I'm excited for those guys. I know that they're looking, you know, they're a subscription basis, and I don't know if they'll stay that way or if they'll ever enter stores. So, but two things I could see, you know, one, all their wines are European wines. They pull from small, you know, wineries inside of Europe.
Oh, really? So none of them are like California or Washington or anything like that.
From what I looked at, and I could be wrong, but from what I initially looked at, most of my thought were all European wines. But their wines are, and it may not sound significant, but it is, significantly less alcohol. They say everything's under 12.5%, but from what I looked at, a lot of them sit around that 11% range. So the alcohol does have an impact. So that impact or that alcohol range being lower is going to be part of the fermentation. So like so we, you know, said, when we do that extended fermentation, so that flavor and that deepness is going to come out of that time frame. So if they have to shorten theirs in order to cut down that ABV, you know, that could potentially be why it's not as bold or as deep.
Because some of your guys' wines are close to 14%, right?
Yeah, a Cabernet is 13.9.
Yep. Yeah. Like I mentioned, like I like my wine with more alcohol. And again, like these dry farm wines, they're good and I've had them, but dude, I swear by your guys' wine. I give it to all my friends and they love it. And I mean, let's not fool ourselves. We're not talking about like $500 bottles of Bordeaux here. I still use all my hacks. Like I take your wine and I pour it out and I use a latte frother, or my kids use the latte frother. We froth it, you know, just like beat the heck out of it for like a minute. Which makes it taste even more amazing. That's my little wine hack. But yeah, I mean, I like your wines of the couple of brands of healthy wines that I've tried. They're dark, they're rich, they're tasty. I mean, kudos. I like them. They're tasty, you know, and
kind of our goal too, Ben, was that, you know, we talk to the point of, you know, the active lifestyle, but we want the general public to enjoy it. We don't want them to say, oh, it's a healthy wine. This is going to taste like crap. And we've done hundreds of tastings, you know, up and down the coast and with numerous people. And we've had those people who come up to the table, and they're a little nervous, and they drink those $200-$400 bottles of wine, and they've said, for better lack of words, they're like, I expect this to taste like crap. And they're like, it's very good, because they automatically assume, like, oh, it's healthy, you know, it's not going to taste good, and they're used to a nice bold cab or something. So our goal was to, you know, have that, you know, that full flavor and full body, but still be smooth, but be drinkable. So for the person who's not the real wine person, but is interested in, you know, starting to get into it, and they're, you know, maybe a little nervous of what to drink, and they don't want to be punched, you know, some cabs can give you that real big hit. So it was a combination of having a full body, but drinkability to it. So that, you know, it could go towards, like you said, the everyday wine drinker, and them enjoy it and make it, like you said, a glass a night. That's what we want, is people to enjoy it on a regular basis.
Yeah, that has freaked out some of my friends before, when I pull out my wine and it's got like a picture of it's like a runner, like a sprinter on the front of your guys' wine, which makes people think that maybe it tastes like crap because it's healthy. Yeah. But it tastes really good. What flavors do you have? What varieties?
So we had initially launched with our Cabernet Sauvignon and our Chardonnay. Most recently, we just released our Sauvignon Blanc. And then coming in the very, very, very near future, ahead of schedule, is our Pinot Noir.
Okay, got it. That's cool. I don't really care that much about your Chardonnay or your Sauvignon Blanc because I don't drink white.
Right.
Yes. Period. I occasionally do when I'm eating fish. I'll have it as a starter. Like if I'm occasionally doing a dinner party, you know, and we're doing multiple courses, I'll start with the white and then move to the red. But I swear by your Cabernet. My wife and I go through a bottle of your Cabernet. I think once every 2 or 3 days now. We go through a bottle of your Cabernet. We have big wine glasses. And the cab is like $16. Most of your wines are like in that $16 to $20 type of range, right?
Yes. The Cabernet and Chardonnay are both $15.99, and the Sauvignon Blanc is $17.99.
Okay, cool. And we've got a discount. If you're listening in, the discount code you can use is Ben10. Ben10 at fitfinewine.com. Assuming you're 21 years of age or older, please do not break the law. Fitvinewine.com, and then the 10% discount code is Ben10, and I'll also make sure that I link to that and a lot of the other stuff that Mark and I talked about, like the articles, the article that I wrote, and then also some of these articles about nasty crap in wine. If you go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com/healthywine, that's BenGreenfieldFitness.com/healthywine. By the way, Mark, when's the Pinot Noir come out? Because I actually like Pinot Noir more than I do Cab.
If I let the hat out of the bag, it's actually being bottled this week.
So, oh, sweet.
It'll be ready for shipment within our fulfillment centers probably in about 2 weeks.
Sweet. All right, cool.
I will be sending you some.
I was going to say, I better get my hands on some. So,
don't worry.
Sweet. Well, folks, if you're into wine, or even if you're not into wine and you're considering stepping off that cliff, you should check these guys out. Fit Vine Wine. You go to fitvinewine.com. You can use 10% discount code Ben10. Grab yourself a Chardonnay, a Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet. Sounds like a Pinot Noir pretty soon. I will verify this stuff is good. I still think you should beat the hell out of it with a latte frother like I do and drink it out of a big old fishbowl size wine glass. And then I'll leave you with my last hack. And that is I rarely actually have the wine with dinner unless I'm having the big old steak, because I like to use it as a palate cleanser between bites of steak. I drink my wine right after my workout, because the fructose in the wine actually is used to restore your liver's glycogen levels. And so it's less likely to get converted into triglycerides or fats, and more likely to just refill your energy stores when you drink it post-workout. So that's always my go-to. Is I finish my workout around like 6 or 7 p.m. I'm usually not eating dinner until 8 or 8:30 p.m. And the only thing that I have during that 2-hour window is a nice glass of this Fit Fine wine. So thanks to you, Mark, for making that happen.
Oh, thank you.
And making it guilt-free.
Yeah.
more than guilt-free. I feel like I'm recovering faster because I get my antioxidants. Well, cool. So again, BenGreenfieldFitness.com/healthywine is where the show notes are, or you can go to fitvinewine.com, use discount code Ben10 to save 10%. Mark, thanks for coming on and geeking out on this stuff with me and creating a few more alcoholics in the world.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, cool. Well, folks, this is Ben Greenfield and Mark Warren signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have a healthy week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.